Today on the Jungle Cast, the week of the Supreme Court, the latest around the world, a piece on vaccinations, and the latest in media news. This is the Jungle Cast. Now, our top story today is the Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage. With the simple words of, "It is so ordered," the Supreme Court ruled in a 5-4 ruling that same-sex marriage is legal across the country. Prior to the ruling, 37 states plus the District of Columbia had legalized same-sex marriage. The decision brings same-sex marriage across the country, and many marriage licenses have already been granted. In some states, it could take a bit of time, as states that were not part of the lawsuit may need to fulfill some legal quirks in order to grant the licenses. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the opinion of the court and was joined by the liberal wing of Justices Stephen Breyer, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Elaine Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Samuel Alito, Antonin Scalia, and Clarence Thomas were all in the dissent, and each wrote their own dissenting opinion. Now, Justice Kennedy invoked the 14th Amendment in his legal reasoning, saying that the amendment mandates that full marriage rights be applied to heterosexual couples as well as same-sex couples. He wrote, "The Constitution promises liberty to all within its reach, a liberty that includes certain specific rights that allow persons within the lawful realm to define and express their identity. The petitioners in this case seek to find that liberty by marrying someone of the same sex and having their marriages deemed lawful on the same terms and conditions as marriages between persons of the opposite sex." The lead plaintiff, Jim Oberfall, filed the lawsuit after his partner had died. Now, Kennedy referenced that in his opinion, saying, "No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than once they were. As some of the petitioners in these cases demonstrate, marriage embodies the love that may endure even past death. It would misunderstand these men and women to say they disrespect the idea of marriage. They're pleased that they do respect it. Respect it so deeply that they seek to find its fulfillment for themselves. Their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right." Now, Justice Scalia attacked the court in his dissenting opinion. He lashed out the five justices, the five majority justices, for believing that it was within the court's realm to rule and mandate the legalization of same-sex marriage. He wrote, "This is a naked judicial claim to legislative, indeed super legislative power. A claim fundamentally at odds with our system of government. Except as limited by a constitutional prohibition agreed to by the people, the states are free to adopt whatever laws they like, even those that offend the esteemed judge's reasoned judgment. A system of government that makes the people subordinate to a committee of 9 unelected lawyers does not deserve to be called a democracy." He then continued with his thought on the, quote, 9 unelected lawyers, end quote, by adding how the justices of the court are not representative of the country. He added, "Justices are selected precisely for their skills as lawyers, whether they reflect the policy views of a particular constituency is not, or should not be, relevant. Not surprisingly, then, the federal judiciary is hardly a cross-section of America. Take, for example, this court, which consists of only 9 men and women, all of them successful lawyers, 18 who studied at Harvard or Yale Law School. 4 of the 9 are natives of New York City. 8 of them grew up in East and West Coast states. Only 1 hails from the vast expanse in between. Not a single Southwesterner, or even, to tell you the truth, a genuine Westerner, California does not count. Not a single evangelical Christian, a group that comprises about 1/4 of Americans, or even a Protestant of any denomination. The strikingly unrepresentative character of the body voting on today's social upheaval would be irrelevant if they were functioning as judges, answering the legal question whether the American people had ever ratified a constitutional provision that was understood to prescribe the traditional definition of marriage." But of course, the justices in today's majority are not voting on that basis. They say they are not. And to allow the policy question of same-sex marriage to be considered and resolved by a select, partitioned, highly unrepresentative panel of 9 is to violate a principle even more fundamental than no taxation without representation, no social transformation without representation. Now, the presidential candidates have weighed in on this matter. On the Republican side, the sentiment was that they disagreed, but how to progress from this differed. Some have said that we should respect the decision, while others called for action to be taken. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who has formed an exploratory committee and has not officially jumped in all the way, he called for a constitutional amendment to allow states to decide the matter of same-sex marriage, as opposed to sweeping the nation. He calls for states to decide. Now, many Republicans have expressed a desire to make sure religious freedom is respected, although religious freedom laws can be a delicate balance, as Indiana learned earlier this year. Indiana passed a Religious Freedom Act earlier this year, and there was an outpouring of criticism, as many believe the act legalized discrimination. On the Democratic side, there was just a general sentiment of agreeing. Now, interestingly, Mike Huckabee used the term, quote, judicial tyranny, end quote, in his response today. Now, what's interesting about that is it's the exact same term he used to describe yesterday's healthcare ruling. Moving on to that ruling, yesterday the Supreme Court ruled on King versus Burwell in favor of the Obama administration. At issue in this case were the federal subsidies with the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. The court ruled the subsidies to be legal in a 6-3 ruling. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the court's opinion, and it was drawn by Justices Stephen Breyer, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Lenny Kagan, Anthony Kennedy, and Sonia Sotomayor. Justice Antonin Scalia wrote the dissent, joined by Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas. The division is similar to that of National Federation of Independent Business versus Business, which was another Supreme Court case that dealt with Obamacare, except that typical swing vote Kennedy joined with Roberts and the liberal wing of the court in this case. National Federation of Independent Business versus Sebelius was decided in a 5-4 matter. Now, four words at the heart of this lawsuit, this being King versus Burwell, the words, quote, established by the state, end quote, led to the perception, or perhaps misperception, that the subsidies would only apply to state-run exchanges. Now, if the court had ruled in favor of King rather than Burwell, it would have ended the subsidies for the federal marketplace. 34 states utilize the federal marketplace, or a partnership marketplace. Now, the removal of the subsidies would have dealt a fatal blow to Obamacare, as the underlying math with the program is dependent upon the individual mandate and healthy people buying coverage. Because what happens is, when the healthy people buy coverage, it keeps prices down. Because otherwise, if you only had sick people buying coverage, premiums and rates would skyrocket because it becomes more expensive for the insurance companies to provide that insurance and that coverage. But by having healthy people come in, and due to the individual mandate, they are forced to buy it, otherwise pay a fee, the insurance companies have an influx of customers, some of which will be sick and will cost more to insure, but also a large amount of healthy people who will just largely, since they're healthy, be paying their rates and not having used much of the insurance. And of course, if only the sick people bought out, and if in some of the cases, if the federal subsidies had gone away, then for the healthy people, in some cases, it would have been in their financial interest to just pay the fine, therefore they would not be buying coverage. The math would get all screwy, and insurance rates would skyrocket, which would then serve as a double whammy to the sick people, because now they're having to pay more money for the insurance, which, as the double whammy comes into play, because they're also having to spend money for whatever medical matter they're dealing with. Now, Chief Justice Roberts looked at the whole law and determined the interpretation of the four words had to be concerned with the whole intent of the law. He wrote, quote, Congress passed the Affordable Care Act to improve health insurance markets, not to destroy them, end quote. Now, there was a lighter Supreme Court ruling this week. On Monday, the Supreme Court ruled on Kimball versus Marvel Entertainment Limited Liability Corporation, a case looking at patent law and royalties. Now, Kimball held the patent on a toy that would shoot spider webs, and Marvel bought the patent while also agreeing to pay a 3% royalty on all future sales. Marvel then sold this toy under Superman branding as the Spider-Man Web Blaster. However, both Kimball and Marvel were unaware of the Supreme Court decision known simply as Brulot. Brulot says that the royalty payments can only last as long as the patent, which would run counter to the agreement that Marvel and Kimball had made, which said that they would pay royalty on all future sales. Now, when Marvel discovered Boulot, it sued in order for the court to act on their agreement and overrule the agreement on the matter of the royalty payments. Now, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Marvel in a 6-3 decision. The court's bill and the opinion, which was written by Justice Elena Kagan, include several Spider-Man references, some of which are used to help explain the court's thinking. We'll go through those now. The first reference came in here, where she wrote, "The parties set no end date for royalties, apparently contemplating that they would continue for as long as Spider-Mans want to imitate Spider-Man." And in parentheses, she writes, "by doing whatever a spider can." Now, this is actually a reference to the Spider-Man theme song, which sings, "does whatever a spider can." Now, the other reference she comes in, "patents endow their holders with certain superpowers, but only for a limited time." There, she's making reference with superpowers, and explains how patents grant the holder certain privileges, but they eventually expire, she says, with the limited time. This relates back to the case where Brulo says that payments must end when the patent does. She also writes, "as against the superpowered form of stare decisis, we would need a super special justification to warrant reversing Brulot." Now, stare decisis is the legal principle of ruling based off precedent. Now, Brulot is the principal in this case, and part of Kimball's argument was that Brulot should be overturned. However, the court argued that there were several reasons that the president should remain, and actually that Brulot's president was indeed strong, contrary to what Kimball was arguing. Now, they actually write that they talk about Brulot with this, where it says, "to the contrary, the decision's close relation to a whole web of precedents means that reversing it could threaten others." Now, here Kagan uses a pun with web to illustrate how other court cases were decided on the foundation of Brulot, and overturning that case of Brulot would impact other decisions. And finally, she touches on it with, "what we can decide, we can undecide, but stare decisis teaches that we should exercise that authority sparingly." Then she references from Stan Lee, Amazing Fantasy number 15, Spider-Man, page 13 from 1962, "in this world, with great power, there must also come great responsibility." So Justice Kagan wraps up her opinion by concluding her thoughts on stare decisis. She acknowledges that the court does have the ability to overturn the case, but that does not mean they always should. She does so with arguably the most famous line in a comic book, a Spider-Man comic, no less. Now this week, California passed a bill that would mandate vaccinations. If signed into the law, which is expected to be, it would be one of the strongest vaccination laws in the nation. TKN's Timmy took a look at this.
Vaccinations. The topic has caused controversy recently. Some parents have argued that vaccines cause issues in children, such as autism. While most scientists and doctors agree that vaccination is very important to ensure the safety of the child, often parents will not vaccinate their children. This has caused the measles virus to spread among other children who cannot be vaccinated. Unvaccinated children who have contracted the disease become carriers and deliver the virus to children too young to be vaccinated or children who are being treated for other diseases such as leukemia. Some diseases, which in the past were not a problem, are now coming back in a manner of which is difficult to fight. With pushback on vaccinations, it becomes a political issue rather than a medical one. One state taking action against the issue is California. Following the Disneyland epidemic, where 150 people contracted the disease, California has offered a bill that would require vaccinations for measles and whooping cough, among other diseases. The vaccinations would only affect those going to public schools or daycares. In addition, those with immune deficiencies or allergies would be exempt. It is uncertain whether or not California Governor Jerry Brown will sign the bill into law. He has shown support for vaccinating children in the past. Quote, "The governor believes that vaccinations are profoundly important and a major public health benefit. and any bill that reaches his desk will be closely considered, unquote, Evan Westrup said. Westrup is a spokesman for the governor's office. If the bill is signed, California will be the third state to ban vaccine exemptions based on religious or personal reasons. 31 states require vaccines, but have exceptions for religious reasons. The bill, if signed, will take effect January 1st, having students vaccinated by July. Many people have opposed the bill, mainly the far left and religious conservatives. They say that if they will not vaccinate their children, they will be denied the right to go to public school. Quote, "We are pulling out all the stops," unquote, says an opponent, pointing out that court challenges and even using a referendum are available. A congressman called it unconstitutional, saying it infringes, quote, "on the rights of certain students to attend school," unquote. Some have gone to extremes in showing their point. Democratic Senator Richard Pan of Sacramento had received death threats and had to increase security as a result. Quote, "People in the opposition say they want children to get these diseases naturally. But children die of these diseases. They become paralyzed. They develop brain damage. This is not something I would wish on anybody's child," unquote, Pan said. The notion that vaccines cause autism has metaphorically been beaten to death. The myth has been debunked multiple times despite pushback from certain groups. Many times, people are misinformed about vaccines, which can cause some fear. Really, a vaccine is a weakened form of the disease that is to be prevented. The body's immune system then can develop antibodies to fight the virus, and the person can no longer contract the virus. The body can be compared to an army. The army is always fighting the enemy, in this case, disease. Each disease is like a weapon. When the army can obtain one of these weapons on their own terms, they can learn from it. This allows them to discover the weapon's weakness. Now, when the enemy tries to fight them, the army knows the weakness and is able to easily defeat them. Recently, measles vaccines have proven to protect from more than measles. When a person contracts measles, their immune system can almost forget how to fight other diseases previously immunized. Quote, "Our findings suggest that measles vaccines have benefits that extend beyond just protecting against measles itself," unquote, said Michael Mina, a medical student at Emory University, who worked on the study while doing postdoctoral research at Princeton University. Quote, "If you get measles 3 years down the road, you could die from something that you would not die from had you not been infected with measles," unquote. In my own opinion, I believe that all parents should vaccinate their children, with exceptions for those with weakened immune systems or allergies. The reasons to have children vaccinated easily outweigh the reasons not to. For one, it can save the child's life. As technology advances, more and more diseases can be prevented. As they are immunized, more of the population becomes resistant. The disease grows smaller and smaller until it may go extinct. As previously stated, vaccines are safe. Numerous studies have been completed, and there is no link between autism and vaccines. Children are not given vaccines until after an extensive review by doctors and scientists. The vaccines are given rigorous testing. Some diseases that previously were thought near extinction have had a resurgence. With more people not vaccinating their children, more and more are susceptible to the disease. Between 10,000 and 50,000 cases of whooping cough have been recorded each year in the United States. Measles has also returned, with an outbreak of 150 struck ill. Some who may not be vaccinated, such as small babies or people with weakened immune systems from diseases like leukemia, are susceptible to the disease. If one thinks their child can overcome the disease and be immunized the natural way, they often do not realize the consequences on others. By having loved ones immunized, one is not only saving emotional hardship, but also economic troubles. Medical bills have skyrocketed, leaving many who were given treatment no means to pay the bill. If the child never gets sick to begin with, there is no bill to pay. As stated before, vaccines can drive diseases to extinction. Smallpox, for example, has become extinct. Following the vaccine, no one has contracted the disease, and it could not reproduce. With vaccines we have now, these diseases may cease to exist in the future. For TCAN and Timmy.
Thank you, Timmy. There are also terror attacks around the world today. 3 attacks on 3 different continents. People were killed at a beachfront in Tunisia, a gas station in France, and a mosque in Kuwait. At least 37 people were killed in Tunisia, and 36 more were injured. There were 3 attackers there, and one is still on the loose. Of the other 2 attackers, one was killed while the other was arrested. Now in southeastern France, one person was beheaded in a gas factory. 2 additional people were injured. The victim was 50 years old, but has not been publicly identified yet. The attacker in this case was believed to be an Islamic terrorist. Islamic flags and writings were left. In Kuwait, there is an explosion there, and ISIS is claiming responsibility. We're going to move on now to the fourth estate for the latest in media news. The Fox News liberal commentator and co-host of The Five, Bob Beckel, was fired by Fox News after his long medical absence, where he was still in the midst of a long medical absence. Beckel has not been on air since February. Mediaite first reported the news on Thursday and reported originally that the split was, quote, amicable. However, it does not appear to be so. Fox News Executive Vice President of Programming, Bill Shine, released a statement saying, quote, "We tried to work with Bob for months, but we couldn't hold The Five hostage to one man's personal issues. He took tremendous advantage of our generosity, empathy, and goodwill, and we simply came to the end of the road with him. Juan Williams and Geraldo Rivera will be among those rotating on the show for the near future," end quote. Beckel originally took time off for his back pains, and then had back surgery. Later, his surgery caused him to relapse with his addiction to painkillers. Now, in other instances, Fox News has stood by their personalities while they go through medical troubles. Anchor Greg Jarrett was out there for several months as he dealt with his alcoholism before returning on air. Now, Beckel has been an integral part of The Five, which airs at 5 o'clock, took over for Glenn Beck's show, and has been a rating success, well, that choice. Now, Beckel, as you said, was important there because he served as the outspoken token liberal. Now, his controversial comments have actually served as fodder for criticism, as Democrats have attempted to distance themselves from him. He's made several controversial comments, including using the term Chinaman, and that has served a double purpose of A, making liberals look bad to Fox News viewers and creating that image of Fox News or liberals being hateful of other groups, and has just provided the liberal there for Fox News to say that they do have liberals. Beckel, did actually work on the Mondale campaign, and as he was one liberal with 4 other conservatives, they would frequently just team up and put on or attack him, the 4 of them on the one. Now, The Five, as we said, has been a huge rating success with the site airing at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and oftentimes places in the top 3 cable shows for the 25 to 54 down, and we should clarify, top 3 cable news shows. Now, Beckel responded to the news on Twitter. However, he seemed confused about why he had been let go. He tweeted, quote, "I'm no longer on The Five or with Fox. Fox statement today baffles me. I will respond in the appropriate forum. I will miss you all," end quote. Then he said, "I just can't un- or, excuse me, quote, I just can't understand the anger in Fox's statement. I was healing from major back surgery. I could not walk. I took no advantage. I got well. End quote. Then, quote, Fox has been good too, especially when I was healing. I guess I'll never understand their anger. It is all so very sad. End quote. And finally, thank you for thousands of tweets. Not angry, but very, very sad. Where I go from here is in God's hands. And if, end quote. And if some of that wording does not make sense, we read them verbatim from his tweets. And moving on now, Lester Holt started as permanent anchor of NBC Nightly News this week. As one person leaves the network, another begins. Although Lester Holt has been at NBC for several years. Now, although the only major difference between this week on NBC Nightly News and last week on NBC Nightly News was Holt's name on the Nightly News branding. Holt has been anchoring Nightly News for several months now due to Brian Williams' suspension. Williams' suspension ends in August, where he'll then move to MSNBC to serve as breaking news anchor. Previously, Holt served as weekend anchor of NBC Nightly News, in addition to anchor of Dateline NBC and Weekend Today. Williams previously served as anchor and managing editor of NBC Nightly News, but was suspended in February for fabricating stories. As his primary substitute, Holt took over and had been anchoring ever since that time. Holt was named anchor last week. However, you may notice that before we said Williams was managing editor. Managing editor is an additional role in addition to being anchor that is typically awarded to the evening news anchor and gives them more control over editorial content. However, Holt was not named managing editor. On CBS, Scott Pelley, and on ABC, David Murr, they are both managing editors. And it is, as we said, traditional for the evening news anchor to have that title. However, Holt says he doesn't care that he doesn't have that title. Now, of course, the Williams demotion raised a large amount of questions, and not all of the questions have been answered. Despite some recent changes, MSNBC advertises itself as a liberal news outlet, Lean Forward, the less version of Fox News. Now, I mentioned the recent changes with Williams coming as breaking news anchor. Now, in addition, Joy Reid and Ronan Farrow both hosted opinion shows on the network, but they were lowly rated. Now, they were both canceled, and Thomas Roberts replaced them with a two-hour newscast, MSNBC Live. Now, despite the criticism that it's not, MSNBC Live is billed as a straight newscast, and when it took over, it was seen as possibly MSNBC moving away from liberal news, or liberal bias. MSNBC has been suffering record lows this year, and the liberal programming has gotten the blame. The open theory of ratings, especially cable news, is that ratings go up when there's conflict. That's why Keith Olbermann did so well when he was attacking the Bush administration. It's why Fox News has been doing exceptionally well since January 2009. When these partisan networks have an enemy, the ratings go up. MSNBC did well in 2012 because they were able to constantly attack Mitt Romney. Now, the problem is that they don't have anyone to attack. The White House is occupied by the president. The 2016 race, while it is beginning, there's been very few proposals so far yet. There's very little on that. And they're not making much news. And of course, the public isn't really interested in the 2016 presidential election just yet. Now, when you're looking at that, the problem is that MSNBC doesn't have anyone to attack, as we said. So Fox News doesn't really have this problem, and they did well during the Bush administration. They were first then. The reason they don't have that is because Fox has liberals on with their internal debates. We just looked at Bob Beckel. Now, while they may have liberals on, and they claim to have liberals on, they tend to be weak liberals. Bob Beckel, as we said, made some controversial comments. He wasn't always in line with the Democratic Party or with other liberals. But also what happens with Fox News is they don't have balanced ratios. It's not like one Republican and one Democrat. What happens is they have several people piling on the weak liberal, and the conservative audience loves it because they're watching their enemy get pummeled. MSNBC, first of all, does not have many conservatives on, but the conservatives they have hired, like former RNC chairman Michael Steele, don't always toe the party line or provide a reliable conservative talking point. Instead, Steele and the like talk about the failures of their party. Steve Schmidt was a campaign strategist for the John McCain campaign in 2008, and he has since been hired by MSNBC. Now, he does not talk about how great the Republican Party is or the conservative policies. Instead, what he talks about is, oh, it was a mistake for Sarah Palin to be chosen as running mate. He, as the conservative strategist, criticizes the Republican Party, which is already being done by the liberal or the Democratic commentator. So what you're having there is you're just having a room or a studio of people just agree with each other, which means no conflict and therefore lower ratings, because you're just watching a bunch of people talk and say, I agree. Now, like I said, there are also questions raised with the Brian Williams. The press release said that Brian Williams will focus primarily on the day side. But what about prime time? Could he interrupt there? A good deal of breaking news happens during prime time, or at least it continues there. Will he be a breaking news anchor like Shep Smith? Shep Smith is the breaking news anchor for Fox News. He lost one of his newscasts when it happened, but he got a new studio, and he has broken into prime time on several occasions to do special reports. Oftentimes it's 10 o'clock. He's done them with different events such as weather in order to cover those major stories for a full hour. Now, as Eric Wemple of the Washington Post has brought up, we don't really know what Williams will be covering. The list that MSNBC provided to Wemple of recent breaking news events are not really worthy of a new anchor. You don't need someone else to come on. They would be easily handled by the regular anchors, especially when you have pretty big journalistic heavyweights on the day side, such as Andrea Mitchell. You have people there who work for NBC News. They don't have a bias or anything, or at least they are straight news anchors, and they've been in the news industry for a long time. They know what they're doing. They can handle it. So it's not necessary to bring in someone else to handle that breaking news. Now, it almost makes you wonder if Williams will basically be doing network-like special reports or special bulletins on the channel. When NBC, CBS, ABC are breaking in, so is Williams, and that's really the only time. Now, of course, days like this would be great, where actually today we had several times when the network's broken for events such as the Charleston funeral, the Supreme Court decision. This would be a great day, but these are for him to break in or for the networks to do these special bulletins, but they're more the exception than the reality. Days, weeks, sometimes months go by without any kind of special bulletin that breaks into regular scheduled programming. So some think that Williams will just be spending a whole lot of time possibly doing nothing. However, there is reporting to indicate that Williams may actually end up with a primetime news program. He may actually take over from possibly Chris Hayes, Rachel Maddow, or Lawrence O'Donnell. They can be moved or just plain old canceled, especially as some of them, like Chris Hayes, have been struggling in the ratings. Actually, Bill O'Reilly this week called Chris Hayes the biggest failure in cable news. So it's possible that Williams may be doing something there as an anchor. Actually, Brian Williams, many, many years ago, while he was being groomed as the successor to NBC Nightly News then anchor Tom Brokaw, he hosted a show on MSNBC called The News with Brian Williams. It was designed, being later on in the day, for if you missed the evening newscast, or they would hope, NBC Nightly News, then you just watch The News with Brian Williams and you'd be all caught up. So it's designed for those kind of people who were missing the evening newscast, but the intention was for Williams to have an evening news-like show, and then he'd be prepared for when Brokaw eventually stepped down. Now, there's also the other question where his role, according to the press release, is that he'll be doing special events. Now, what are special events? TKNN has asked MSNBC, and they haven't responded, saying what these special events are. Special events sound like the inauguration, election night, the State of the Union. We'll be having all three of those in the upcoming years. We'll have an election night 2016. That's going to be significant. We'll actually be having a lot of election night coverage where you have the primaries and the caucuses. You've got Iowa coming up in several months. You've got the State of the Union coming up next year because that's an annual event. Now, these events are, at least on MSNBC, are currently hosted by Rachel Maddow, who is the star of the network, and Chris Matthews. Now, those two co-host the coverage, and they appear alongside a panel of hosts, or regularly hosts, who for that night are commentators, in addition to additional commentators. Now, if Williams does one of these events, one imagine there's larger changes. It would be hard to see Williams hosting their coverage because right now, to picture the setup, it's almost like a triangle, or in some cases it's been almost like a circle or a semicircle, where Matto and Matthews are sitting there, and then they just turn at the table and talk to the fellow commentators. It would be hard to see William at that table, let's just grant that there are no additional changes, giving or anchoring and then just tossing or looking right at the liberal commentators for their opinion. You would imagine there'd have to be some kind of change there. They'd have to provide actual real conservatives there for Williams to turn to. Because the network publicly and privately has said that MSNBC is an opportunity for Williams to rebuild his trust. Now, obviously, it's going to be hard for him to rebuild his trust, especially among conservative viewers, if he's on MSNBC and he's only talking to fellow liberals. After the controversy first erupted with Williams, conservatives were some of the loudest ones calling for him to be removed. And all evening news anchors, or most of the mainstream media, has trust problems with conservatives. So, of course, it's going to be harder to gain back their trust, but it's going to be even harder when you have them on MSNBC, because they view MSNBC, rightly so, because MSNBC advertises as this, as a liberal news organization. Now, of course, it's possible they could do it like CNN. CNN, the way they do it is they have Wolf Blitzer, who's the lead political anchor, that is his title, and for this coverage like election night, he's there, he gives the vote updates, and then he tosses to someone else with Anderson Cooper, who moderates the panel. Now, that's what you could see there with MSNBC is Williams is there just to provide vote updates, and then somebody else goes and moderates the panel. But again, it would be hard to see Williams associate himself with an almost exclusive liberal crowd while he's trying to rework or rebuild his credibility with the entire nation. And of course, many viewers come in from Middle America. Now, as we can see, attempting to answer these questions raise more questions. If he goes on MSNBC, what does he anchor? If he anchors election night coverage, what does that look like? Trying to answer one question raise more because we have a lack of answers from the network. Although there seems to be a larger question here, which is, what's happening to MSNBC? We're watching, as we said, the network struggle with low ratings and possibly look at reinventing themselves, maybe going towards straight newscasting as they were before, possibly having more of a mix, gaining more of a balance, having the primetime dominated by liberal voices, but in the daytime maybe doing more straight newscasting. We're seeing a lot of changes possibly in the work for MSNBC, and Williams may just be one part of that. Moving on now, we have a good deal of polling released this week, and it's all related to the 2016 presidential race. So it's time to look at the state of the race. Now first, we'll look at the Democratic side. A New Hampshire poll from CNN continued to show Hillary Clinton the lead. However, her lead was significantly smaller than her campaign is used to. In the poll, she leads Senator Bernie Sanders by only 8 percentage points, 43% to 35%. Now, New Hampshire, as we see on the Republican side, is also throwing in some quirks. A new poll from Suffolk University finds Donald Trump surging to second place in the state. Jeb Bush remains in first place with 14% of the vote, and Trump is in second place with 11%. All the other candidates were in the single digits. Although we should also note that Trump has consistently done well in New Hampshire. And so this is an uptick, yes, but not as large of an uptick as would be in some other states. And New Hampshire, as just historically, has always done better, or fringe candidates have always done better in the state. The live free or die, the state tends to favor them. Kind of candidates that don't have that much of a shot, Bill Bradley in 2000, they tend to do better in New Hampshire. Just the way the state rolls. So, we also have, but going back to the New Hampshire poll, Governor Scott Walker, Senator Marco Rubio, and Dr. Ben Carson, they round out the top five. Walker has 8% of the vote, Rubio 7%, and Carson 6%. Now, Governor Chris Christie, who has been expected to announce a presidential run. And if you look on Twitter, you'll actually see invitations to his possible, or to his presidential run. It's basically confirmed by the invitation. You can actually look at the political director from CNN, David Chalian, who is on Twitter of David Chalian, at David Chalian, Chalian. If you look at his, he actually tweeted out the invitation, and it's pretty explicit that he's running for president, because it says, you're invited to join Governor Chris Christie and First Lady Mary Pat Christie, Finance Chairman Ray Washburn, Master of Ceremonies and host Todd Christie, and the Chris Christie for President team for the presidential launch and announcement and call day. So, pretty clear what he's announcing there, and that's on June 30th he's going to be announcing presidential run. Now, Chris Christie, as if you look at polling, has fallen significantly. In 2012, the polling showed him very down. He was doing well in 2016 polling. However, controversies such as Bridgegate have obviously hurt him, and some of his flash has kind of faded away, so he's been falling in the polls. And in order to get back into the national discussion, Christie has been focusing a lot of his time in New Hampshire. Christie's been doing a lot of town halls there, where he shows off his frank style of telling it how it is and oftentimes getting argumentative, thinking that that honesty trait would play well in the state. However, he only had 5% of the vote, which may be all right for the state, and certainly, I believe that was sixth place that lands him, or right around there. He is not doing as well as he probably would like to be doing. Now, the poll itself from Suffolk University is a tad quirky based off the amount of candidates included. 19 different candidates were included. It included former Governor Bob Ehrlich from Maryland, former IRS Commissioner Mark Everson, and former Governor Jim Gilmore from Virginia. Now, of those three, only Everson had announced a presidential run. And as you could probably expect, all three of those placed very low in the poll, right around zero. Now, the poll also asked what candidates the viewers would like to see included in the Republicans' debates. In the Republican debates, Fox News and CNN have both announced their criteria and the format for their debates, and Fox's, which is first, is based upon polling and limits it to the top 10 places. Not the top 10 candidates, but the top 10 places. Bush tops that poll, the poll of who they'd like to see included in the debate, with 83 respondents saying he should be on the stage. Marco Rubio falls with 80% of the vote. And despite placing second in the main poll of who they support, only 60% said that they wanted Trump to be included. When it comes to matters of inclusion, if you look at a ranking, Trump placed 11th. Now, showing that voters would like to have an inclusive debate, all but three candidates had a majority support from amendments. The only three that did not have majority support are Ehrlich, Everson, and Gilmore. Now, while Donald Trump does place second, it is not all good news for the businessman. His favorability ratings are underwater, with only 37% holding a favorable opinion, while 49% hold an unfavorable opinion. Trump is the only Republican, whose name was tested, that had underwater favorability ratings. And obviously, when you look at his favorability ratings, it starts to become a little more clear about why he placed so much lower in the inclusion poll. Now, we also had a national poll released this week from Fox News looking at the Republican race. Jeb Bush was in first with 15%, and in second place was Donald Trump with 11%. After that was Dr. Ben Carson with 10%. All of the candidates placed in single digits. The remainder of the top 10, just so that we're looking at it, because the Fox News poll, or the Fox News debate, excuse me, is dependent upon national polling, were Rand Paul, Scott Walker, Marco Rubio, Mike Huckabee, Ted Cruz, Carly Fiorina, and Rick Santorum. Now, we had an additional candidate join the race this week, Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana. Now, he was expected to announce the run at a rally Wednesday afternoon, but he instead posted a video online. The video shows Governor Jindal and his wife, Supriya, telling their children that he plans on running for president. Governor Jindal also tells them that if they behave, they might get to go to Iowa. His one son responds by saying that his favorite part about Iowa is the popcorn. Jindal's political stock has been on the decline over the past few years. In 2009, Jindal delivered the response to President Obama's address before a joint session of Congress. it wasn't a State of the Union, but it was after or when a new president takes office in January, typically they don't have a State of the Union, but they, or it's not called a State of the Union, but they do deliver a joint address oftentimes. So Jindal responded to President Obama's address in 2009. Now, however, his delivery style was criticized and compared to Kenneth Page from 30 Rock. Kenneth Page, if you're unaware of the program, is a character who's from the Deep South, speaks with a little bit of a twang, and also not all that bright. But in 2012, Jindal declined to run for president and instead endorsed Governor Rick Perry's president's run. Perry is running for president this year in addition, and later he campaigned for the Romney-Ryan ticket. And as we said, his poll numbers have been steadily on the decline ever since 2012, or ever since kind of 2009, but certainly much lower than he was in 2012. Similar to what we saw with Chris Christie, where both of those were very competitive in 2012, not so much in 2016. And of course, the differences between 2012 and 2016 are also pretty elaborate, whereas in 2012 you had Mitt Romney as the front runner, that many voters did not want to see the nominee, and therefore you saw the monthly anti-Romney take first place, or first or second place. And you also had, because it was the President Obama running for re-election, and typically presidents do fairly well, especially modern-wise, for re-election, you didn't have some of the strongest candidates come out. And so you had candidates like Newt Gingrich or Ron Paul come out. Although Ron Paul was running for president, has run for president numerous times. You had some weaker candidates come out, candidates that the voters were not that thrilled about, and therefore you saw that fluctuating, and certain people test potentially as very strong candidates just compared to those who had announced. Now, as we said, Jindal has been struggling in polling. His national polls hover around and below 1%. His numbers are similar in the other states of Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. Democrats responded to Jindal's announcement by asking in a press release who he was.
Just a few days ago, the nation encountered a tragedy in Charleston, South Carolina. Since then, there has been a movement to cut down the amount of Confederate flags. Many see the flag as a symbol of racism due to its history as the flag of the Confederate States of America. The Confederate States of America was the country formed by seceding states during the Civil War. However, since then, it has remained divisive. While many associate with racism, a very significant portion of people in the South still hold it up as part of their heritage. The South has a complicated history with the Confederate States of America. In addition to flying the Confederate flag, many states have landmarks named after figures associated with the short-lived country. However, due to public outcry, we're seeing the business community come out and bow to public pressure. The largest corporation in the world, Walmart, announced it will stop selling the Confederate flag at its locations and online as well. Walmart said in a statement that they, quote, never want to offend anyone with the products that we offer, end quote. Other corporations were quick in their response to this issue, including Amazon, Sears, and even Apple. The company removed apps with the Confederate flag from the App Store. However, that has led to some criticism, as some of the apps removed were games and include the Confederate flag only to be historically accurate. Even eBay took a strong stance in announcing their removal of the flag, saying it, quote, became a contemporary symbol of divisiveness and racism, end quote. Along with these strong stances by these major corporations, South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley was quick to note how this Confederate flag, quote, while an integral part of our past, does not represent the future of our great state, end quote. She was referring to the Confederate flag that is hanging up at the Capitol in South Carolina. While many corporations are still continuing to condemn the purchase of these flags, we're still seeing that a huge wave of people are going out of their way to buy these flags. Before Amazon banned the sale of the flags, Confederate flag sales were up by 5,000%, and they were one of the top-selling items in their patio, lawn, and garden category.
Continuing on, Russian President Putin and American President Obama had never been known to have a close relationship, but yesterday President Putin called President Obama. The White House says that the two discussed ISIS, Syria, and the Iranian nuclear talks. President Obama also brought up the crisis in Ukraine and the Minsk Agreement. Well, thank you for joining us on the inaugural edition of the Jungle Cast. Be sure to follow Political Jungle on Twitter, at TKNNPaulJungle, P-O-L, Jungle, and send any comments or ideas our way. We've got a lot of things planned for this here podcast, so stick around. Till then, though, this is Tyler wishing you good news and a good night.